Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
It is about local food. Next to that, it's about regional food. Next to that, it's about national food.
That's how Matt Ewer conceives of his food delivery business. We'll talk to the co-owner and CEO of Green Bean Delivery about how it works for both consumers and farmers. Going local can be tricky for chefs who need lots of food to fill out their menus. That story's from Harvest Public Media. How the U.S. became the world's leading exporter of cattle embryos. And for spring, we go to the strawberry patch at the White Violet Center at St. Mary of the Woods, where the battle with the weeds is on. And Daniel Orr then whips up a very seasonal dessert of biscuits and berries. Updates from around the food world with Luann Johnson.
The world's largest retailer issued non-binding guidelines to its suppliers that included an appeal to provide sufficient space for animals and reduce non-medical use of antibiotics. In the company's request, it expressed support for the five freedoms for livestock animals set down by the UK government's Farm Animal Welfare Council, including freedom from hunger, thirst, discomfort, pain, injury, disease, fear, distress, and the ability to express normal behavior. In a statement, Walmart president and CEO Wayne Pacelli called for an end to battery cages, gestation crates, and veal crates that immobilize animals. The company's guidelines are voluntary and do not include a deadline for its suppliers to comply. The move follows announcements in recent months from companies calling for reduced use of antibiotics. McDonald's said in March that it would curb use of antibiotics used in human medicine. And in April, Tyson Foods announced it would stop using them by 2017. Another two food businesses have announced changes to how they make their products. Taco Bell and Pizza Hut announced they will remove artificial colors and flavors. Taco Bell has given itself the deadline of the end of 2015 to swap out artificial colors and flavors for natural ones. They'll address other additives and preservatives over the next 2 years. Pizza Hut is moving more quickly. The artificial colors and flavors will be out by the end of July. Both restaurants are part of Yum Brands. This falls in line with similar announcements from Kraft and Nestle. GMOs will be out of America's leading commercial baby formula. That's an announcement from Abbott, the maker of Similac Advance. As the New York Times reports, most mainstream baby formula contains corn and soy, the vast majority of which are grown from genetically modified seeds. Similac already offers an organic baby food that doesn't contain any GMOs. But consumers were eager for a GMO-free version of Similac Advance, which is said to be more similar to breast milk. And an Ohio-based recycling plant has come under fire from the Food and Drug Administration after they allegedly sold oil laced with industrial waste as food-grade soy oil. Suregreen Farms of Ansonia, Ohio, sold at least 2 shipments of waste oil intended for fuel use only as recycled restaurant oil. A West Michigan farm then used the tainted oil unknowingly in its turkey feed, killing 47,000 turkeys and ruining 500 tons of feed. Seitzema Farms of Allendale, Michigan, estimated their losses worth $100 million. The FDA sent a warning letter to Suregreen, noting their investigation into their operations had uncovered adulterated and misbranded animal food. The letter required the firm to put into writing how it would bring its operation into compliance within 15 days of receipt of the letter. Keep up with all the latest news with the help of our Twitter, at EarthEats.
And the website to read more about these stories, eartheats.org. Always great to kick off the show with Luann Johnson.
Thanks, Annie.
You've probably heard of a stud bull before, a favored male cow that mates with the herd. But a stud dame? They exist, and demand for their offspring is growing. Harvest Public Media's Abby Wendell reports.
Panda stands 6 feet tall, weighs almost a ton. She's broad-backed and round-rumped with a thick hide of black hair, spotted creamy white.
She's a big-time cow. She's a freak of nature is what she is.
Dan Byers breeds elite cattle like Panda in western Illinois, selling calves to show at state fairs and national competitions. At 8 years old, Panda should only have had 7 calves by now. But the cattle industry has a way around nature's limitations, a procedure called embryo transfer, or ET. Instead of having one calf a year, Panda can have dozens.
There's definitely a lot of extra work that goes into it compared to just raising them like you would normally. But ultimately, when the cattle are good, then, you know, it should hopefully be more for your bottom dollar, I guess.
First, she's injected with hormones to produce multiple eggs. Then she's bred. The fertilized eggs are her embryos. Think of them as complete genetic packages. And the next step is getting those packages out. That's Dr. Michael Pugh's job. Today, he's stationed at Panda's rear, donning boots, overalls, and a plastic glove up to his shoulder. He sticks Panda with an epidural, then slides his entire arm inside.
It seems so routine to me now, you know, when you just reach in a cow and do what you gotta do.
Pugh massages Panda's uterus, helping the embryo slip through a catheter into a receptacle slightly fancier than a Dixie cup.
The best part for me is when you go look at the embryos in a dish and you realize that, you know, those are calves right there, you know. So it's still pretty cool when you see that all the time.
Panda produced 6. The embryos now head to another barn where they're inserted into less valuable cows who will carry them to birth. But ET is used for more than breeding lots of showy cows at once. Ranchers use it to export American cattle genetics around the world.
They go almost everywhere.
Matthew Wheeler is a professor of animal sciences at the University of Illinois and has been involved in the embryo business since the 70s. He says U.S. genetics are a hot commodity because American cows are efficient milk and meat production machines. That's partly because we've got lots of land, water, and feed, but it's also because we've bred them that way for over a century.
You know, I was just got done teaching class, and I was telling the students, since 1940, we've decreased the number of dairy cattle in the U.S. by half, okay? And we've increased the milk production by 2.5 times.
America exports about 15,000 embryos a year. Full-bred beef embryos fly off to Australia and Brazil. High-end dairy embryos voyage to Japan and China, where they're implanted in local surrogates. Wheeler's lab is doing something different. He's working to develop a decent, low-cost embryo for countries who struggle to produce enough milk. For instance, in Rwanda, the cattle population was wiped out by the civil war.
So they're interested in not only, you know, redeveloping their cattle herd, but if they're going to do that, they want to do it with better genetics.
Back at Dan Byers' farm in western Illinois, expectant cows pace around the pasture. 140 of them are pregnant, the majority with embryos from only a handful of donors. Surrogate mother number 4030 is clearly ready to give birth.
You can, like, see her abdomen pushing out.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
On this occasion, the embryo calf is coming out backwards, so Byers calls the vet. The men use a crank to try and muscle the calf out. The cow's knees buckle with pain. After a few more attempts, they opt for a C-section. The vet makes a large incision in her side, tugs, and the newborn calf slides out. If all goes according to Byers' plan, she'll grow up to become another American show cow champion. Abby Wendell, Harvest Public Media.
Later on today, getting enough local produce to fill out a restaurant menu is tough business. We hear from wannabe farm-to-table chefs with Harvest Public Media in the second half. Matt Ewer has been both an entrepreneur and a farmer his whole life.
Ironically enough, I sold sweet corn door to door when I was a kid. And we had a family farm that was farmed by another family. We put sweet corn along the side of the field corn because I asked my dad when I was little, I said, where's all the corn that you can eat, right? And he explained, well, this is all for cows. But beside the point, we would go out there, harvest the sweet corn. I'd take it back to Marion, Indiana, where I'm from. fill up the van and put it in the garage, and I would literally go door to door, Red Flyer wagon. I know it's probably bringing up images of Norman Rockwell and all this stuff in your mind. People would wait on me, you know, and I started to get a reputation, and maybe that was a lesson for me at a very young age, that people wanted to be connected to agriculture and people wanted to have a face with their food.
He is one of the faces of Green Bean Delivery. It's an online, on-demand grocery store where the food comes to you. A lot of it is organic and regionally sourced from mid-sized farms.
We're trying to mix the service that you get from, you know, a more streamlined grocery with the service that you can get from a CSA or a farmer's market, and put those things together. And when we do that, we create a commercially viable product. And then when we turn our support over to a local farmer and artisan, we really make impact on their business and their family farm. That's how you cultivate change.
Ewer knows what it's like for farmers. He is one. He worked at Strangers Hill Organics when he lived in Bloomington, Indiana. He now helps run two certified organic farms as part of the green bean business, one in Indiana and the other in Ohio. From the farmer's perspective, they deliver their food to one of the company's five distribution centers, Indy, Louisville, St. Louis, Cincinnati, Nashville, and Columbus, Ohio. And then Green Bean does the work of getting it to the consumers. When he describes it like that, Green Bean sounds a lot like a certain model we've talked about on Earth Eats recently.
Yeah, and you know, food hubs are interesting conversations. I hear a lot about food hubs. We've been going since 2007, and we consider ourselves a food hub. So when I hear those conversations, oftentimes I'm like, "Hey, over here, you know, check us out." You know, food hubs are not just about the brick and mortar, right? The concept of a roof over food, right? It's actually what is the business model, and that's what we're trying to show is, you know, viable business models, market solutions to get local food, sustainable food, organic food to consumers at an affordable level, make it very accessible and easy for people to get to. So we want it to be a key, convenient, affordable, and accessible.
If you play around on the Green Bean website, you'll see organic food from the United States, but not too much labeled from Indiana. That's because they're still tied to the seasons. So apples, for instance, come from Argentina right now. But come fall, they'll be sourced from Indiana farms. If you want Indiana produce, your best bet these days is to get some lettuce and kale.
It is about local food. Next to that, it's about regional food. Next to that, it's about national food. And those all come together in kind of a food security conversation, right? If California dries up, are we going to have the ability to really support ourselves, make sure we can still eat our lovely fruits and vegetables? Right now, I'd argue that we don't. What my company is trying to do is build commercial viability and business solutions and sustainability for family farms.
Matt Ewer is the CEO of Green Bean Delivery.
I run a tech company, and we found a way to create, you know, this bridge between technology and the amazing resources that it can provide to our community and agriculture.
It's been around since 2007, and it's now making deliveries in southern Indiana. You can take a look for yourself at greenbeandelivery.com. Coming up, we talked about planting strawberries back in March. Now in late May, you probably have some fruit to harvest. There are definitely baskets full at farmers markets. Daniel Orr has a great strawberry shortcake recipe for us with sprigs of mint plucked from his garden.
And when it's this young, you can even throw some of the stems in. It doesn't matter. They're tender. It's only when, you know, mint gets older and gets woody that you really need to worry about the stems.
Love this. Stay with us. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations. Bloomingfoods.coop. Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Hello again, Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Last year around this time, I had the pleasure of visiting the gardens at the White Violet Center for Eco-Justice on the campus of St. Mary of the Woods College in West Central Indiana. The sound of bells follows you around the grounds. It was magical. Candace Minster showed me their struggling strawberry patch.
They did not like the winter, which is really ironic because they're alpine strawberries, and they did not survive the winter.
Well, yeah, I hate to tell you, but all I see is dandelions.
I know, and the dandelion are very clever because they took root exactly where each little strawberry plant was planted. And the leaves on a alpine strawberry look a little different than the June bearing or day neutrals that we're used to in Indiana. So they actually, when the dandelion's young, they camouflage pretty well.
Well, yeah, I guess the leaves on there are sort of pointy, just like a dandelion.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
She's the garden manager there. Weeding is a constant battle for organic farmers. The White Violet Center has been growing chemical-free since 1995, and they've just recently re-upped their status as USDA-certified organic. To suppress the weeds, they mulch a lot, and it's handy that they can reuse all the grass clippings and leaves from around the St. Mary of the Woods campus.
The other issue that our strawberries have to contend with are the deer, and they love to eat the strawberry leaves. So far they're leaving them be, but a little later in the season, they really just go crazy. And then the strawberries themselves can get burned, or then the birds can see them more easily, and then they're eating them. So it's an ongoing battle.
Minster has tried a variety of tactics to fight pests, none of which really work for the long term. At the beginning of the season, they overplanted the alpine strawberries, knowing some crops would become snacks for wildlife.
The floating row covers were beneficial to a certain degree, but now our deer know that tasty things are underneath the white fabric, so they will just tear right through the fabric. We do some spraying of... It's actually blood that we will get. It's a product that's called plant skid, and we can spray it in our pathways, not on the food. So we don't want it on our food crops, but we can do it around the beds, and that smell will keep them at bay for a little while. But then as soon as it rains, then we need to reapply it.
And then, of course, they can always try divine intervention.
I can tell the sisters to pray that the deer find other things to eat.
I touched base with Candace Minster this week to see how the strawberries are faring this year. Much, much better. They harvested 35 pounds of fruit to distribute to their CSA members. But it's not alpine strawberries. No, Minster said they decided to go with June bearing and those day neutrals instead. She is the garden manager at the White Violet Center for Eco-Justice at St. Mary of the Woods. Those dandelions, oh, by the way, you can eat those too. Find young dandelion greens and make our recipe with sausage and potatoes. EarthEats.org to check that out. Serving food from local farms is one of the hottest trends in restaurants. Many customers want to know where the eggs in their omelet come from and how their chickens are raised. But when chefs want to go local, where do they start? For Harvest Public Media, Eleanor Klibanoff takes a look.
It's opening day at Heirloom Bakery in Kansas City, and the line is out the door and around the corner. They've sold out of their homemade Pop-Tarts, the quiche of the day, and the cinnamon rolls. Baker John Vanderheit is left pushing the strawberry mint chia scones.
Yeah, the flour is from Heartland Mills, and that's in Marienthal, Kansas, I think. The mint is from Gibbs Road Farm, one of the local farms here that supplies some of our vegetables and herbs.
They're scones with a pedigree, and they're selling like hotcakes. Scott Meinke owns Heirloom Bakery with his wife, Kate. They moved back to Kansas City to open their business, mainly for access to farm-fresh food.
Kansas City, like, we're in, like, America's heartland. I mean, there's flour, there's eggs, there's pork, there's poultry. I mean, there's so much surrounding us that it doesn't make sense to not utilize that.
They assumed they'd just find some farmers and set up shop. But the Meinkes quickly realized that even in the heartland, going local is harder than it sounds. There are two big problems for chefs that want to serve locally sourced food. For one thing, running a restaurant requires a lot of food, and local farms tend to produce smaller quantities. Meinke says they needed to find multiple sources for everything, from chicken down to herbs and seasonings.
So like rosemary, we go through a lot of it for a larger scale operation. It's just hard for them to harvest that much and then for it to regrow back within a week.
Even a small bakery like Heirloom ends up working with over 20 different farms. Meinke says that's a little more complicated than calling up U.S. Foods and getting a truck full of produce delivered when you need it. It
takes time remembering, like, Mondays you have to order from this farm so they deliver on Thursday, and Tuesday you order from this farm so they deliver on Friday.
And that's the second problem with sourcing local food, finding farmers. Farmers and chefs inhabit two very different worlds.
There's about 500 chickens in here.
David Keston owns David's Pastures in Concordia, Missouri.
They're a week old. They'll be in here for one more week, and then they'll all go and pasture.
They're so cute.
Yes, they are.
Keston used to work in restaurants. He left the business in part because he didn't like the quality of meat they were receiving or the conditions the animals were raised in. Now, he raises his chickens on pasture with GMO-free food. Yes, that costs more, but he says it can pay off, as long as you can connect with the restaurants that want them.
Every month we get probably two new customers because we answer emails, we answer phone calls. And they say, well, I tried that other farm, but they'll never call back or they don't answer the email.
That's the exact problem that Kristen Wolf is trying to solve. She owns Windhaven Farms, which is actually less a farm and more a girl in her truck. She takes orders from restaurants and then finds farmers that have what they need. Grass-fed versus grain-fed beef, cage-free eggs, and so many, many chickens.
I'm a middleman, but it's just because it's hard for my farmers to farm all the time and then bring their animals to the slaughterhouse, get them processed, and then bring them into the city.
And she says the farmer-chef relationship is one that needs a liaison. She knows farmers aren't great about email, for example, and that chefs can be intimidating.
They're always busy, and sometimes they're a little bit fussy. I know a lot of farmers talk about how scary it is, like going in and trying to talk to the chef sometimes.
Many cities have food hubs that help connect farmers to interested buyers. Kansas City is talking about developing one, and Wolf says she hopes more people will start doing what she's doing.
Okay, four muffins, gonna be $13.
Even if you can get enough different farms working happily with chefs and restaurants, there's one problem that Kate Meinke at Heirloom Bakery knows she can't overcome. Winter.
You know, when it comes to, like, December, January, like, you have to buy from the larger distributors just in order to, like, sustain and not just be selling only, like, one muffin.
She says they'll stockpile what they can and find interesting workarounds when possible. But that's the cold, hard truth of farm-to-table. It's nearly impossible to be all local all the time. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Eleanor Klibanoff.
Check out other stories from around America's food landscape at harvestpublicmedia.org. Over the years, I've been asked plenty of times what's my favorite Earth Eats recipe, and that's just impossible to answer. If I had to pick the most versatile dish, though, that's much easier. For sure, it's Daniel Orr's biscuits. He adapted this from his grandmother's recipe.
You know, you can use it for so many things. We've used it for biscuit biscotti. We've used it, you know, served with goat cheese, make them with Parmesan. You could throw some wild garlic chives in the biscuit mix. And, you know, there are lots of ways to use it. But today we're going to make it into a dessert to celebrate spring strawberries. So I've got a nice dish of strawberries, probably about 3 to 4 cups of strawberries. I'm going to put a little bit of local maple syrup. This comes from Burton's Maple Camp. Probably about a half to three quarters of a cup of maple syrup.
What grade maple syrup are you using?
Well, this I like to use the grade B. Grade B is, I would think, a little gutsier. Grade A is for pancakes, you know, where you're really going to taste the maple syrup without a lot of other confusing elements. But when you start adding other things like, you know, the sweet acidity of strawberries, it would distract from grade A syrup. So use grade B for those things. I'm going to add about a half a lemon's worth of juice. Now, again, with desserts, a lot of times I'll add a pinch of salt and just a little pinch of freshly ground black pepper. The French in Brittany, they do a caramel that they coat with sea salt. So,
but the pepper in there as well?
The pepper, too. There's a famous dish in Italy that's strawberries with balsamic vinegar and cracked black pepper.
Little green mint leaves are also getting tossed in here. These came off his plants this morning.
These are really perfumey. You know, they've been waiting underground all winter long. They're going to the disco when they come out. And when it's this young, you can even throw some of the stems in. It doesn't matter. They're tender. It's only when, you know, mint gets older and gets woody that you really need to worry about the stems. Kind of sprinkle that over the strawberries. We're going to toss this. Now, you can let this macerate for 10 or 15 minutes, and it's only going to get better with a little bit of time. All right, so I've got these nice biscuits. They're warm from the oven. I'm going to just put a little bit of strawberries on because I want to top these with ice cream. And if I put the ice cream directly on the biscuit, it would melt too quickly. And then what I like to do is to take a little bit of yogurt, and that's going to cut down on the sweetness of the ice cream. And I just kind of drizzle that around the outside and then decorate it with some more of those mint babies. Okay, and that's mint and maple strawberry shortcake.
Dessert for breakfast? Maybe replace that ice cream with some yogurt, and there you go. Although we're not going to judge you. If you do enjoy ice cream first thing in the morning, hey, go for it. Pictures of this, step-by-step instructions, and lots of other goodies at eartheats.org. Our crew is made up of Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepard, and the reporters at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations. Bloomingfoods.coop. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Back again, same time next week. We'll save you a seat. I'm Annie Corrigan.